TED Audio Collective.
Hello, I'm Chris Anderson. Welcome to the TED Interview, the podcast series where I sit down with a TED speaker and we take a deep dive into their ideas. On today's episode, Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert and the weird, often counterintuitive science of happiness, and much more. Over the years, Dan has dedicated himself to challenging people's perceptions of the world and themselves through a better understanding of our psychology. In a classic TED talk recorded many years ago, he made me completely rethink what I understood about human happiness.
Human beings have something that we might think of as a psychological immune system, a system of cognitive processes, largely non-conscious cognitive processes, that help them change their views of the world so that they can feel better about the worlds in which they find themselves.
So he calls this synthetic happiness. And at first, I hated the idea, but he won me over. In this episode, Dan and I start with a detailed exploration of why synthetic happiness is both surprising and kind of cool. And then we go on to explore what he's been studying more recently, including the odd science of conversations, the relationships between generations, and why our minds worry about things we really needn't worry about and fail to worry about things we really should worry about. Dan Gilbert, welcome.
Happy to be here.
So Dan, we're going to talk about a lot of different things in the next hour plus. I'm going to talk about happiness, about conversation, about how our sense of self changes over time and future threats and so forth. But there's an underlying aspect to all these topics, which is just how weird and unexpectedly our minds behave so often. This first talk you gave back in 2004, I can't believe it, so long ago, it was one of the first TED Talks that absolutely exploded on the internet. It was so exciting to see this thing take off. And at the time you gave it, this was the second year that I'd put together a program at TED. We had this theme, which was the pursuit of happiness, which seemed to me to touch so many different aspects of not just psychology, but technology, design, and so forth. And you were really the star speaker on that theme. And what you said blew away the room. I mean, it astonished people. And I still find it astonishing looking back on it now. So for people who haven't seen it, first of all, you should. But you know, could you give us like the 1 minute summary of some of the things you said in that talk?
You know, in that talk, I focused on a very recent human ability called prospection, which is the ability to look into the future, to conceptualize a world that has not yet happened, but will. Prospection is a very recent talent, evolutionarily speaking, and we're the only animal on the planet that can do it in the way we do. So it isn't surprising that when we imagine the future and our place in it, we make mistakes. My 2004 TED Talk concentrated on one of the mistakes we make when we look into the future and try to imagine how we'll feel about the events that are unfolding. In particular, that error is overestimating how badly we will fare in the face of future adversity. Human beings, it turns out, are remarkably resilient. We are a species that picks itself up by its bootstraps and gets going. It doesn't get knocked down for long. But we don't seem to know this about ourselves, and so when we imagine our future, we imagine a variety of events that could utterly devastate us, and we take action in the present to forestall them, sometimes actions that are unwise and imprudent. So what I tried to share with the audience was some experimental evidence showing that people are pretty darn bad at predicting how they will feel in the future when things don't go their way.
And there's a converse to that as well, which is that they're pretty darn bad at predicting how happy they will feel about certain actions, that we are sort of lured to want stuff that we think will make us happy. Turns out we're often wrong about that.
That's exactly right. The good things aren't as good and the bad things aren't as bad as we assume they will be. Now, that's not to say good things aren't better than bad things. Of course they are. It is better to get a promotion than to lose a job. It is better to find out you're healthy than to find out you're ill. One thing is better than the other, but the difference between them just isn't as large as it seems when you're looking at them in the future. These events loom larger than they are.
You started the talk with a spectacular example of that, which I think subsequently you've walked back a bit. I mean, the example you gave was that lottery winners, a year after they've won the lottery, are no happier than paraplegics a year after their accidents. And that had the whole room gasping, and it was like there couldn't have been a more dramatic way of making the point. And I think since then you looked again at the numbers, and that was one of the examples where you'd kind of winged it a bit live. What was the correction that you made there?
There is an iconic study in psychology done, now almost 40 years ago, maybe more than 40 years ago, in which the happiness of lottery winners and paraplegics is compared. And what the study finds is that the differences between them are much, much smaller than anybody would think. I'm pretty sure in my TED talk, I mistakenly said there were no differences between them. And to scientists, that's night and day. The difference between no difference and a little difference is a big difference. With that said, although the data from that particular study are probably a bit questionable, the point it makes has been verified over and over again in four decades by very rigorous studies that show that when people look into the future, the negative events that they anticipate do not turn out to be nearly as different from the positive events as they think they will.
Mm.
So the lesson of that study is right, even if the data themselves are a little bit wobbly.
And you gave these amazing examples of like someone who'd been in prison for many years, who came out, said, you know, that was actually a tremendous experience. And Pete Best, you know, who missed being in the Beatles, was just displaced by Ringo Starr, who later said, you know, I think I'm happier not in the Beatles. This was sort of spectacular evidence of this ability to create what you called synthesized happiness. I mean, what's the difference between synthesized happiness and, quote, natural happiness?
You know, those examples are wonderful when you first hear them, and you're right, they're amazing. But if you start doing what I do, which is to keep your eye out for them and collect them, you eventually get tired because they turn out to be utterly common. Constantly, I am reading in the newspaper, online, in a magazine, someone who didn't get what they wanted, whether they lost an election or their marriage failed, telling the world that they are not only okay, but much better off as a result. What I wanted to impress upon the audience is that these things that seem miraculous are actually ordinary, that this is the way most people react to negative events. They find a way to make the best of what's happened to them. It's a natural human talent, and I referred to it as an ability to synthesize happiness. Most of us think of happiness as the thing we get, the reward we get for getting what we want. I want her to say yes when I propose, and when she says yes, I feel happy. Happiness is my reward for achieving that which I'm aiming for. But what I tried to point out to the audience was we also find a way to be happy when we get exactly what we weren't aiming for, when we fail to get the things we were striving toward. And I gave some examples. Now, of course, examples are always easy to cherry pick, and so I tried to follow that up with some hard experimental data showing that in very ordinary circumstances, people faced with a decision or a dilemma will look forward in time and say, gosh, if that happens, I will feel devastated. And then moments after it happens, they say, you know, maybe not the best day of my life, but a lot better than I thought.
But Dan, isn't it possible that this is not evidence of happiness being synthesized? It's evidence of humans being good storytellers, you know, that our narratives, our self-narratives really matter to us. We're very good at telling stories, and we can't bear the narrative of life is crap forevermore. So we just make up story, but it's at some level, it's not actually true.
Will, I do think it's making up stories. I just think those stories are just as good as the one you were making up when you were aiming for something you thought you could get. It's all just stories. And so I don't think that the kind of happiness we achieve when we build it for ourselves after adverse outcomes is in any way inferior to the kind of happiness we would have achieved if we'd gotten what we were aiming for. You know, when I ask her to marry me and she says yes, I feel happy. The quality of that happiness is not very different than the happiness I create for myself after she says no, and I think through the relationship and come to realize that although there were many good things about it, there were ways in which we weren't very well suited. And in fact, there were certain aspects of her personality I didn't enjoy very much, and you know, she didn't get along that well with my mother. Is that just a story, Will? I don't like the word just. It is a story, but it's a story that also captures truths about the event. So maybe I think the best way to think of it isn't that one story is true and one story isn't. It's that one can look at any event and think of its positive or its negative features. Both of those feature sets are very real. So dwelling on them is, of course, only to partially understand the event, but it's partially understanding what is in fact true. Maybe the bottom line is that when people are rationalizing, they aren't just making crap up. They aren't fooling themselves. They are coming to a different but equally reasonable understanding of the events that have occurred for them.
But isn't there a difference between, in theory at least, between reported happiness and the actual feeling? Danny Kahneman talks about the difference between experienced happiness and the remembering self. Like, you could picture two scenarios where they're both saying, yes, I'm feeling happy about myself. But in one scenario, that there really is a sort of like a deep inner peace, or that, you know, dopamine, or that warm sort of feeling of buzz or whatever. In the other case, it's not really there, but they're having to tell themselves that story. Is there a way to distinguish between those two circumstances where you can be confident that the narrative is actually genuinely synthesizing happiness, as it were?
Well, there are ways experimentally to do that. For example, I talked in that 2004 TED Talk about a study in which we asked people to pick a poster that they could get to take home. And we created a scenario in which they would be a little disappointed by their choice. And what you normally see is that if you ask people later which poster they really like, they will tell you they really love the one they got, and that one that they originally wanted but left behind, now that they think of it, you know, it's really not so good. Now, that sounds like somebody telling themselves a story. It sounds like somebody just fooling themselves. It sounds like somebody who's not really happy with their choice, but is just pretending to be happy with their choice. How can you know? Well, in this study, what we did is we used a special kind of participants who had amnesia. So these participants made a choice, and then we waited a little while and saw how they felt about their chosen object long after they'd forgotten it was theirs. And what we saw was that the thing they chose really was liked better, even later when they didn't know they had chosen it. That's the kind of evidence that suggests to us that when people are rationalizing, they really, truly are changing the way they feel about things. They're not just saying that.
Mm. That was super powerful, that story, and kind of mind-boggling. Paradoxically, when I heard that, Dan, at the time, I was thinking, okay, this really is strong evidence that we make our own happiness after the event, and that the way that we make it, we're not good at predicting how that will happen. And my initial reaction to that was sort of surging disappointment. I want to think of happiness as this sort of life goal, you know, it's this beautiful thing that we aspire to and work for. And at first blush, my reaction to the talk was, oh no, you know, just chemicals. It's just, you know, stuff being synthesized in our minds in ways that we don't even know and control. That felt disappointing initially. Why was I wrong to feel disappointed?
Well, it's not surprising to me that a Brit would look at some of the most optimistic findings on the face of the earth and find a way to think of them as dark. Chris, I have exactly the opposite experience when I think about these findings. Look, most of us think that happiness is a rare gem. And if we're lucky enough at the end of a long journey, we can possess it. What my research and research like that suggests is happiness is actually a pretty ordinary rock. And you can find it at many places along the way on your journey. You think you're headed for the one and only hope diamond. But the fact is that your path is littered with beautiful, precious, and semi-precious stones. Happiness will be easier for you to find than you imagine. Now, how can that be bad news?
I think, as with so many of these things, you know, like I had a similar reaction when someone tried to explain to me that love was really just associated with certain chemical enzyme activity in the brain and whatever. It's like, no, it's the soul of the universe, don't you know? And but when you figure out just how rich a mind is, you know, a sense of wonder eventually kind of came back. And I think in this one too, I ended up being delighted by what you'd said, partly because it gave a roadmap to greater self-knowledge, greater self-understanding, and almost like a confidence of certainly that if something bad happens to you, you actually have all the tools within you to move past that.
Well, that's exactly right. And I just want to ask why. Why it is that if love or happiness, as you say, boils down to some chemicals in the brain, it's any less worthwhile than you thought it was in the first place. I mean, the Mona Lisa boils down to atoms. That's what's at the base. It's just made of atoms. But do we then say, well, oh my, it's not a beautiful painting after all. It's just a bunch of freaking atoms. Of course not. Those atoms come together in remarkable and mysterious ways to create one of the most beautiful paintings on Earth. The same is true of all the neurochemical interactions of your brain. Yes, every thought and feeling that you have that has ever been had by any human being is the result of the activity of these little on and off switches called neurons. That doesn't make these activities any less magical and amazing just because they are the product, ultimately at the lowest level, of neurochemical transactions.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think in people's start point is that they want these things to be external to themselves. They want them to have a kind of platonic reality sort of out there, a part of a bigger story, and that, you know, we are sort of adventurers in pursuit of this bigger story, and to be told, actually, this thing that you're questing is inside you all the time, and that there's a biological explanation for it. It takes getting used to, and I think it is a beautiful moment to move past that and say, okay, now let's reframe the terms in which we tell this story of the dance that we're in and reflect for a moment on the astonishing richness and magic of the biological beings that we are. This isn't a dumbing down of emotion. It's an enriching of biology. You know, the path that got us here is far more breathtaking than you could ever imagine. And when you do that, then yes, I think it does become beautifully inspiring.
Well, damn it, man, I could not have said it better myself. I'd like to invite you to give a TED Talk. It was beautifully said. That's exactly right. You're exactly right. Isn't it wonderful to find out that we have these abilities? I don't think it cheapens the thing we are chasing to realize that it has always been within us. Isn't that kind of the story of The Wizard of Oz? You remember Dorothy going on her quest to find something somewhere at the end of a long road? And at the very end of the movie, she realizes that the thing she's always been looking for has always been right there inside her to begin with.
Hmm.
Well, it's kind of a cheap sentiment, but it turns out Dorothy was right.
So that makes me grateful for biology and our psychology the way it is. There are two aspects, though, that make me kind of mad at how how we're designed. And they're both to do with the other side of prospective happiness. The fact that people believe that they will be happy if they can, basically, to be very blunt about it, consume a bit more, have 20% more than they have, that becomes so many people's de facto goal, and including me, by the way, for most of my life. And you can understand completely the evolutionary power of that. So you had two types of hominid, and one is just greedier than the other, and they're prepared to work a bit harder for that extra 20% more of land or value or whatever. They're going to gradually elbow the others out and take over the planet. And that seems to be kind of what's happened. And the fact that 3 months after they got that 20% extra land, they're as miserable as they were before, just seems like a bloody deceitful trick that for most of evolution was just bad news on the human who is the subject of that, you know, kept us constantly on this sort of striving hamster wheel of, you know, must have a bit more, must have a bit more, must work a bit harder. But now is actually threatening the whole planet by, you know, creating this sort of ravenous species. If you could edit the pen of, you know, evolution and change some of that, wouldn't it be nice to kind of do that?
Well, you make a very important and somewhat depressing point. We are consumers. And there's no doubt that when you take a bite of chocolate and think, gosh, that was good, the next thought is, wouldn't more be better? It's only natural to keep wanting to get more of what has pleased you in the first place. Virtually every animal on Earth functions on this principle, which B.F. Skinner called the principle of reinforcement. Do again that which felt good when you did it the first time. The basic rule of behavior. The problem is that in the short term, this is a pretty good rule. In the long term, it's a disaster. for just the reasons you point out. First of all, it's not going to make you happy in the long run. You keep consuming, you keep getting more, and you keep ending up pretty much back where you were. It's like a person running on a treadmill, and they notice at some point that they're not actually moving anywhere, and so they think, I need to run faster. Well, you're really missing the point. It doesn't matter how fast you run on a treadmill. You never leave the spot where you started. The problem with this consumerist urge is that it's natural. But the good thing is, it's not inevitable. Now, we happen to live in a society that encourages it. It encourages it because our economy is based on it. I mean, we're only here to consume goods and services from the point of view of the invisible hand of the marketplace. But it is possible for human beings to think differently, and you know that because you probably know people who think differently. People who have kind of gotten off the treadmill, who've said, you know, I kept buying new cars and new suits and new houses, and then one day it occurred to me there were never going to be enough cars or suits or houses to make me happy. And so I started doing something else. The fact that human beings can do this, and the fact, in fact, that some cultures can be focused on that kind of growth, tells us that our consumerist urge, if natural, is not inevitable. There is another path for us if we can figure out how to take it.
I think most people are familiar with the evolutionary psychology sort of framework now that says, hey, you know, we evolved for a different time. Is that a big part of the explanation?
Well, you know, you asked, why should we be this way? And one answer is, why shouldn't we? Hmm. That is, why should every aspect of a machine be evident to the machine? There's really no reason for you to know everything that's going on in your own mind. Your job on Earth is to survive and reproduce. That's it. And so we seem to be designed to know enough about ourselves to get that job done and not too much to make it too complicated.
I mean, I remember when I first started reading evolutionary psychology, and I was suddenly hit with this insight or realization that, for example, you know, Richard Dawkins' selfish gene onwards, you know, which is that you don't necessarily share the same interests as the genes that built you. That was shocking to me in all manner of ways. Like the core idea there is what that the genes are selfish. They are designed to maximize their own survival. Oftentimes that requires the survival and flourishing of the bodies and minds that they're building. But there are times when it may not. You described it just then as, you know, the job is to, you know, get that job done. So long as you do well enough to survive and reproduce, job done. But whether you're happy during that process, whether you're satisfied, whether you have a meaningful life, evolution doesn't really give a damn about that. Is that fair to say?
That's not only fair to say, that's exactly accurate. We are not designed for full self-knowledge. There's no advantage to it. In fact, there may be ways in which it's occasionally a disadvantage. And so to attain self-knowledge, to really understand ourselves, how our minds work, and how other people and their minds work, requires the methods of science. We have to be able to dig beneath the surface of our own experience to find out the way we really work. To me, that's what legitimates the science of psychology.
Mm. And so specifically, when you look at something like happiness, there's a sort of rude awakening if you think, wait a sec, happiness might not be just this sort of spiritual dream that many of us yearn for. You can also think of it as an evolutionary device used by genes to manipulate the beings that they've created.
Yes.
You know, boy, if we could persuade someone that they thought they would be happy if they did action X, that could achieve, you know, a benefit to the body, to the species maybe, but it doesn't matter if there is deception involved in that, so long as it gets job done.
Well, that's exactly right. People often say, you know, evolution doesn't care if you're happy. That's nonsense. Of course it does. Pleasure and displeasure are the carrots and the sticks that nature uses to guide us to and away from the things that are respectively good and bad for us. If you take a list of all the things that make most human beings happy, from sex to chocolate, and you take a list of all the things that make them unhappy, from death to famine, you notice something about the items on the list. The items on the first list basically enhance your survival and reproduction, and the items on the second list are a threat. That fact is information about what pleasure and displeasure are for.
But when you dive into the details, you can find quirks and anomalies where, for various reasons, things that we think will make us happy actually may not be in our own best interest, or certainly not in the best interest of humanity as a whole in the 21st century.
Well, there's no doubt about that. The things that bring us pleasure and displeasure, that we imagine will bring us pleasure and displeasure, usually do in the very short term. Where we're really wrong is how much pleasure or displeasure they will bring us in the long term, especially the very long term. You bring up the topic of society and community. So it's true that when you take a bite of chocolate, you will experience a moment of pleasure. That's where nature's plan ends. What isn't true is that it will lead you to pleasure over the long term, because enough chocolate will rot your teeth, it'll make you fat, it'll cause you to die too young. Nature doesn't care about that. It just wants you to bite the chocolate now. We're designed to mate and to survive in the now. Our ancestors didn't have a long-term future to worry much about.
There wasn't chocolate at every street corner. If you found some, gobble it. And that was your best chance at surviving the next month. Yeah.
Exactly. Take what you can now and let later take care of itself. Later is an invention of the modern human mind, and it's a miracle that we can even think about it at all.
You know, the entire narrative of success, national success, it's all based on the idea of kind of consuming more stuff from GDP measurement. You know, bad news this month, GDP didn't go up. It's like it's really woven extraordinarily deep into how economies function, how news is reported, how politicians are elected. Is there any scenario where a counter-narrative really takes hold and that we could sort of collectively adopt a better wisdom on this?
Well, I think that's the right question. You're asking for an existence proof. Hey, Gilbert, if you really think it's possible to get off the treadmill, can you just show me somebody who's done it? That's exactly the right question. Yes, you can find individuals who have done it. You can also find groups that have done it. For example, certain religious groups. If you go and hang around with all the people surrounding the Dalai Lama, you will not find a lot of people who are worrying much about their next car, their next suit, or their next home. So we know small groups of people have found ways to get off the treadmill. It's even possible for nations to get off the treadmill, or at least to take a break from the treadmill. From Bhutan to Sweden, you see societies that are not as deeply concerned with consumerism as American society in particular seems to be. So do Swedes want more? Yes, but it's a tempered desire. The understanding is that, yes, it would be nice to have more, but it's not worth sacrificing too much to get it. In Bhutan, the king is not as worried about gross national product as he is about a measurement called gross national happiness. And he's worried about how to maximize the well-being of his citizens apart from the GDP. So, yes, I think there are sparkles of light all around us that tell us that is possible. Now, the hard question, how could we get from here to there? If you know the answer to that question, there are a dozen Nobel Prizes waiting for you.
Well, let's challenge the audience with that. Want Nobel Prize? Figure out an answer to that problem.
Canva presents unexplained appearances. It was an ordinary workday until...
That presentation appeared out of thin air.
Also, it's eerily on brand.
Wait, did that agenda just write itself?
Words appear, making this unexplainable case...
Unexplainable? It's Canva's AI tools.
I can generate slides and words in seconds.
Really? The real mystery is why I'm only learning this now.
Canva.com. Designed for work.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
A surprising thing about you, I mean, you dropped out of school. Why did that happen? When did that happen? Don't tell us that story.
I do wish I could say I dropped out of school on principle because I wanted to study psychology and they wouldn't let me. That would be a bit fanciful. I dropped out of school because they thought I should show up for classes rather than playing my guitar and smoking dope by the river. And it just seemed to me that they had their priorities wrong. So, you know, yes, I dropped out of high school and became a science fiction writer, as a matter of fact. And one day I wandered down to a local community college thinking maybe I'll take a writing course that will help me with the stories that I'm beginning to write and publish. And the writing course was closed, but the psychology course was open. It had been a very long bus ride down to the campus, so I signed up. You know, that was the first domino to fall. I found it was fascinating. Writing nonfiction seemed more exciting to me than writing fiction. I was hooked. That was the beginning of my life as a psychologist.
So maybe if they had had that introduction to psychology class at school, you might have done less dope and I don't know, whatever. But
I'd like to think so.
On the margin. And then, what, 20 years later or so, there you were at Harvard, you know, doing this extraordinarily interesting, innovative research. It seems as if humans are really prone to a form of self-deception in so many aspects of their psychology. That right there in itself is a bit of a puzzle. What could a psychologist tell me? I am me. I know myself uniquely. No one knows me like I do. I'm here all the time. So why would it be the case that our minds, in a sense, you know, deceive us quite a bit of the time?
Well, you're exactly right that people are prone to self-deception, but they're also prone to self-bafflement. They're prone to surprise themselves. They are made of things they don't fully understand.
I'd love to hear some of the more recent work that you've been working on, because all of it is based on unpicking these riddles, these unexpected behaviors that we don't see ourselves clearly.
Well, you know, you're exactly right. For me as a scientist, I have a hunch that almost every scientist does their best work in the first 10 years that they're thinking about a problem. And then after that, they start to become people who are dotting I's and crossing T's. One of the things that they have been bringing to my attention in the last few years is conversation. Now, conversation is, by any measure, the single most common human social activity. I mean, if only because almost every other social activity incorporates it or even depends on it. So when I became interested in the psychology of conversation, I was pretty sure I would be able to open a number of books and start reading all I needed to know about human conversation. Those books are largely absent. We know an incredible amount about language and how it's used, but we don't know what people are doing with it when they sit down and say, "Hey, what's up? I don't know. What's up with you? I don't know. I had a fine cup of coffee the other day. Really? Where'd you get it?" What are people doing and how do they do it when they do that ritual with each other? Psychologists know more about the basal ganglia than they know about what two people talk about and how they talk about it when they sit down to talk. So, you know, there's nothing more exciting for a scientist than believing you've discovered an undiscovered country. And so we wandered ashore and just started taking pictures of the flora and the fauna. And that's what we've been doing for the last couple of years.
Is it a finding from this research that we perhaps deceive ourselves if we think of conversation as primarily being about, you know, an exchange of information, that that's often not what's going on, and that the term conversation actually is a cover for perhaps 1,000 different activities, everything from the giving of comfort or love or friendship or affection or humor or whatever. Like, there's actually 1,000 different things going on under the surface, and that we think of it wrong. It's really not about fresh words sort of conceived eloquently in the moment. It's about 100 other things.
That's a fantastic insight, and you're exactly right. When I first thought about conversation, I thought conversation's the technology by which I take information from my mind, I formulate it into language, and I transfer it to yours. And some conversations are like this. You stop and you ask somebody, "Can you tell me how to get to the public library?" And they say, "Yes, you go down the block and turn left." That's a conversation whose purpose was the exchange of information. What that person knew is now something that you know. I would suggest to you that that is the rare exception in human conversation. Most of the time, people are not trying to exchange information. They're trying to engage each other and invest in a relationship. When two people sit down and say, "What's new?" "Oh, I don't know, not too much. I took a trip to Houston recently." "Really? What did you do?" Nobody is really interested in the information that they are gaining or giving. What they're interested in is forming or maintaining their social relationship. So, you know, I think you could probably liken what human beings are doing with conversation to what baboons do when they sit down and groom each other, when they, you know, pick nits out of each other's fur. We're basically sitting next to each other and saying, "I like you, I like you, I like you, I like you." And the person says back to us, "I like you, I like you, I like you, I like you." But those words are not the ones we're using, but that's really what we're saying. Conversation is a social activity in which people cement bonds between them. And in fact, a lot of the time, they have to struggle to find some information to exchange. Now, if conversation were about information exchange, you just wouldn't have them when there wasn't information to be exchanged. People, most conversations really have no information to be exchanged. People sit down and work to have them. They have to think of something to talk about. Why are they doing all that work? Because conversation is the way we cement social relationships. So I want to sit in your presence, and I want to move my mouth, and I want words to come out. And then I want you to do the same thing. And we're going to have a little dance together, and you have to obey all the rules of the dance. We have to do turn-taking. We have to interrupt in the right ways. We have to ask questions about what the person just said. But those are just the formal rules of the waltz. What we're really doing there is dancing.
And you know, one of the most painful signs of a relationship in trouble is when, you know, you see people go out to dinner and they don't know what to say to each other, and they sort of sit there in silence. I wonder whether there's actually any advice based on what you're learning here for people. It may be as simple as, I don't know what to say that's interesting, what question to ask that would interest me. That is just the wrong question they should be asking internally. It's more like, if you thought of conversation as, here is a chance to groom my partner in a beautiful way. Does that change the kind of things that you might figure out to say over dinner? Like you could say anything. I don't know. Like, have you tried to turn this to practical advice?
Exactly. You know, you see that couple sitting there in silence, not talking, and you think they've run out of things to say. Nonsense. They never had anything to say in the first place. What they've run out of is the will to say nothing to each other. That's the problem in their relationship. If you looked at their first date, they were probably not saying that much either. They were talking about nonsense, because most of us talk about nonsense most of the time. What they've run out of in that relationship is the willingness to just move their mouths and make words come out, whose real meaning is, "I like you. I enjoy having my mind tuned into yours. I want to engage with you. I want to ask you questions so you'll feel that I'm interested, and I want to tell you things so I'll feel you are." That's what's gone wrong in that relationship. The lack of conversation is by no means a lack of material, because there's rarely that much material in the first place. I think that lack of conversation is a symptom of something. It's not a cause. And I think if you gave those people something to talk about, it wouldn't change the relationship. The relationship is in trouble. They're not interested in engaging each other. If they were, they would talk about the same nonsense the people at the next table were talking about. I used to have a salt shaker like this. It was so funny, but then I lost the pepper shaker. I never could find it again, and I always wondered where it went. Well, where do pepper shakers go, by the way? I mean, do they go the same place that missing socks do? What a nonsense conversation we could have. But if we really are enjoying each other, we're both laughing and giggling and having a good time doing it. Conversation isn't about what you're talking about. It's about the fact that you are talking with each other.
And what are some of the early insights or possible insights?
One of the things we've discovered recently is that people can't tell when other people are repeating themselves. And that's probably a darn good thing, because so much of human conversation is just replay. Look, very few of us have as many experiences worth sharing as we have conversations in which we want to share them. And so we go around telling people the same stories that we've told to others. In fact, we worry sometimes, maybe I've told you this before, that we're repeating ourselves to the person we're talking to. And yet, conversation feels fresh, doesn't it? When you sit down with a friend and you say, "Hey, what's been up lately?" And they say, "Hey, you know, I came back from Paris. We had a really great time. We went," and your friend starts to tell you about the trip to Paris. You don't have the sense that your friend is reading from a script. You have a sense that your friend is fresh, that he's generating his speech on the fly, that these things he's thinking to tell you about are just coming into his mind, that maybe he hasn't told anybody, or at least not many people, about his trip to Paris before. What we've discovered is that people have a fresh talk illusion. That is, they are utterly unable to detect repetition in human speech, and they have a bias to believe that the speech they're hearing is much fresher than it is.
How did you find that out?
We discovered this by doing what must be the simplest experiment in all of psychology. I'm just shocked that no one's done it before. We brought people into a laboratory, and we had them sit down and just tell a personal story about an event that had happened to them recently that they'd never told anybody, and to tell it to the camera. So they were talking to the camera, relaying a personal story about something that had happened to them, and it was for the very first time. They'd never relayed this story before. Once they did that, they spent about 90 seconds doing that. We asked them to do it a second time, and then a third time, and then a fourth time, until they had done it 10 times in a row. So for each of our speakers, we had 10 takes of their personal story. We then took each of these takes and showed it to a panel of observers. And we asked them simply to guess which take it was. Is this the first take, the fifth take, the tenth take? What did the observers guess? The observers, first of all, were wildly inaccurate. The correlation between their guesses and the actual number of the take was virtually zero. They had no idea what take they were seeing. But most importantly, they almost all thought they were seeing a very early take. Almost all of them believed they were seeing take one, take two, or take three. In other words, they showed a fresh talk bias. They believed the person was really pretty unpracticed and had almost never said this before. Why did this happen? Our data suggest that observers believe there are two characteristics of speech that can tell you whether it's fresh. First of all, fresh speech should be inarticulate. People who are extremely fluent have probably practiced a lot. People who are stammering and stumbling, well, they're probably new. Second, observers believe that fresh speech is exciting and enthusiastic. People are excited to tell a story for the first time, and then they're bored by the time they've told it over and over again. It just turns out that both of these theories are pretty much wrong. Most human beings stammer and stumble the first time, and they stammer and stumble the tenth time. People are pretty bad storytellers, and they remain bad even when they repeat their speech. Second, people are deeply engaged when they're telling stories about themselves, and they remain deeply engaged over multiple tellings. As a result, the tenth take just doesn't look very different from the first take. Nobody can easily tell them apart.
So this is fascinating work on conversation. What else are you working on?
I am starting to study intergenerational perception, and I never thought I would. I never thought there was such a topic to be studied. But, you know, over the years, a funny thing has happened. I've gotten older, and I'm now 61 years old, and my graduate students, who used to be a year or two younger than me, are now an entire generation separated from me. So talking to them is this fascinating intercultural experience, talking over this great intertemporal divide, if you will. And one of my graduate students and I had so many fun conversations about the differences in our perspectives on, well, almost everything as a result of the differences in our ages, that we started to wonder why nobody was studying how people like him thought about people like me and vice versa. Indeed, the lack of research on this topic is a little bit stunning. If you think about it, psychologists, for example, in my world, are obsessed with variables like race and gender. And there's lots of research on this. Here's a simple test. If I said, Chris, do you have any female friends? You'd say, well, of course. If I said, Chris, do you have any black friends? You'd say, yes, surely. If I said, Chris, do you have any 17-year-old friends? You'd say, are you out of your mind? If I said, well, do you have any 91-year-old friends? You'd say, you're equally out of your mind. In other words, you are living your life in a very tight age bubble, interacting with people who are roughly around your age, and you've been doing this your entire life.
So tell me, Sam.
I once again just caution to say we're in the early stages of this. Tomorrow, we could find out everything we're thinking today is wrong. But at least at the moment, one of our early findings is that people believe that aging has been a really wonderful thing up till now. And it's all going to go downhill from here. What's interesting is this seems to be the belief of people at almost every age. 30-year-olds tell us that they've gotten much nicer, much wiser, much smarter, more capable, kinder since they were 20. But they expect most of these things to get worse as they turn to 40, 50, 60. When you ask people who are 40, 50, 60 how they feel, they say the same thing. 60-year-olds tell us, oh, you know, aging's been fantastic. I am so much better than I was when I was 50, 40, much less 30. But from here on, it's probably pretty much downhill. So we all seem to have this theory about aging that it's a really bad thing, except for the part that I've already experienced.
I mean, that would be a great thing to teach people at every birthday. You know, I know this feels a little depressing, but just so as you know, in 10 years' time, you're likely to feel this was the best decade of your life and that you continue to grow. Why are we deceived about that?
You know, we're very attached to who we are, right? We really like being us. And any change to us feels like a threat. It feels like a bad thing. If I told you, Chris, you know, if I could rearrange your face and make it look different, would you want me to? You might go, you know, my nose could be a little bit. Basically, you want to remain looking like who you are. You certainly want to keep your personality. You want to keep your memories and your traits and your proclivities. We love being us. And so aging seems like some process that will make us less us. And so it sounds pretty bad.
And Dan, is there any interest in combining these two research agendas, studying, if you like, for want of a better word, intergenerational conversation? There's all these interesting recent stories of experiments where you place students who are struggling to afford their housing in forms of sort of like either old people's homes or living with older people. And there are some pretty great stories that are coming out of that, but I don't know how much actual science there's been on the impact of that. At one level, it seems pretty obvious and hopeful that the, you know, older people can be energized and delighted by having the proximity of younger people and that younger people could actually learn a lot from those conversations. Worth studying? Are you planning to study that?
Well, I don't have plans to do it, but what you're saying is actually something that several psychologists have thought themselves. You know, we're highly segregated in our age cohorts. Wouldn't it be great if we weren't? And there have been studies in which they've tried to, you know, basically set up young and old people to spend time together. And, you know, the results, as such as they are, suggest that people do get something out of it. But I think what's interesting is to question the very premise of this. Is it really not a good thing that we're trapped in our cohorts? I mean, who says we should be interacting with people across generations? Why would that necessarily be better for us? If you think about it, people of your race and gender may share some of your attributes more than people of a different race and gender do. But people of your age, oh my gosh, their lives are all about the same projects that your life is about. If you're 32 years old, you're probably thinking about children and marriages and mortgages and careers. It's nice to spend time with other people who are obsessed with those things. If you hang out with a bunch of 75-year-olds, they're not worried about any of that. They're basically thinking about health. They're thinking about posterity. They're worrying about the, you know, the demise of classical music. It's nice to be with people with whom you have something to say. So I'm not quite sure that I would want to be in the position of recommending that we undo the age stratification in our society. I'm very open to the possibility that that would be a good thing, but I think it needs to be studied.
So it feels to me like a really important topic though, Dan, because I mean, a lot of people would say that one of the unintended consequences of sort of modern mobility and traditional deep community ties that the world, you know, was kind of built on in a way, have fractured. And that even though it might not be a person's first choice to hang out with someone of a very different age, when they do, people actually get value from it. And that, you know, it might turn out to be like a core part of ensuring deeper community bonds.
It's funny, you know, Chris, I'm doing this research with a graduate student who's, I believe, 26 years old. I'm 61. And I asked him one day, I said, you know, if we randomly took a 75-year-old and a 21-year-old and made them spend an entire day together, who do you think would hate it more? And without missing a beat, he said, oh, the 21-year-old. I said, no, it'd be the 75-year-old. And he looked at me astonished. His theory is that old people love to spend time with young people, but young people can't really stand us. I had the same theory until I became an old person, and now what I know is that old people look askance at young people. They find them insufferable. They want nothing to do with them. So we have a little private bet about who would hate that day the most. You're placing your money on both of them having learned something and loving it. So it would be a fun experiment to do. Maybe we should go out and try.
When it comes to psychological self-deception, the most single troubling aspect of it to me is there seem to be really profound bugs in how we think about what to worry about, how we think about what are the things that we should be most hopeful about for the future, what are the things that we should worry about most. The things that we end up worrying about, you know, we spend huge amounts of money on that could have been spent on other things, and things that are deeply threatening to humanity, we tend to ignore. I would love your latest thoughts on this, Dan.
Our worry should be proportional to the size of the threat. But, you know, the human mind wasn't designed to do math. It wasn't designed to make these calculations in a rational way. And so we spend a lot of our time worrying about the kinds of things that would have worried the ancestors from whom we're descended. We worry about people. We worry about bad people doing mean things. We worry about threats that are threatening our well-being today. We let the future take care of itself. All of these kinds of things make us worry, I think, about the wrong stuff a little too much and the right stuff a little too little. So, for example, take two threats, two things we're all concerned about, climate change and terrorism. By any measure, climate change is the bigger threat. There's simply no way that terrorists are going to wipe out the species, but it's not hard to envision how climate change could lead to that end. And yet, we spend more time and worry, we spend more money combating terrorism than climate change. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't care about terrorism.
And the numbers are really quite shocking when you dig into them. Certainly when you look historically at the number of deaths, for example, through terrorism, it's like number 252 on the list of all the things that cause people to die. Every disease, almost any kind of accident that you can think about is a higher risk so far than terrorism. And yet we spend, I think it's like at least two orders of magnitude more on terrorism than on battling climate. And what's especially galling about that is that the people who are terrorists are specifically using this psychological hack. It's like they're specifically saying, hey, what could we do to most annoy humans, to most get their attention? And they do it. And we go, oh, you've got our attention. You've got our attention.
Absolutely.
You've got our attention. Let us write about you on the front page of our media for the next 3 months. And so people despair over this. Like the people whose life's work is to work on the climate issue, for example, they despair over how to break through. And some of them end up arguably almost going down the, like, you know, we clearly have to evoke as much fear as we humanly can. Possibly some of them even overstep the line on that. Do you have any advice as a psychologist as to how we might be wiser in our public conversations on how to get closer to looking at the real threats?
Well, there's no doubt that a threat like terrorism hijacks the human brain. I mean, we are evolved to worry about a big man with a stick growling at us and threatening to hit us. And terrorism is just that. Terrorists have to do very, very little to cause us to spend a whole lot of time, energy, and money because they know exactly what to do. There's a villain, an evil villain, who is going to do damage to us now, and he's going to do it willfully and intentionally. Those are all triggers for the brain. Those are exactly the things that get us to stand up and roar. Climate change, on the other hand, has none of these properties. It's abstract. It's going to happen later. It's not being perpetuated by some bad guy with a mustache. It's actually the result of collective action. All in all, it's kind of inert. It doesn't feel like a major threat. Now, rationally, we know it is, but it's not the kind of threat that our species was evolved to react to swiftly with all of its resources. So what can you do? Well, you have exactly two options. Either you can find a way to completely change human psychology so that people actually do respond to threats like climate change, and you can probably guess that's not likely to happen. Or number two, you can frame climate change as the kind of threat to which people already are prone to respond. And I think that's exactly what we need to do. I'm not saying I have specific suggestions for how to do this, but we have to make climate change feel much more like terrorism. It has to feel like the evil acts of bad people who are trying to hurt us and take our stuff. Once that happens, we will be out in the street protesting to make sure more money is spent to thwart it.
I mean, that message is getting through to a lot of kids now. And I sometimes worry that there's millions and millions of kids around the world growing up like deeply depressed, like sickened by worry about the future. Is that just like a price that we need to pay to get, you know, shake us all up? You know, there's a lot happening, but it's come from kids really starting to view this as a sort of a do or die question for their future. I guess they're just they're right to have that feeling. It's okay for kids to grow up terrified.
Well, you don't want people to grow up terrified, but you certainly want people to grow up understanding the magnitude of a threat. And I think that young people who say, "Gosh, is it really wise for me to be imagining the extinction of my species?" Well, if you want to forestall it, it is, because that actually is the dilemma we are facing. So I think it's bad to be more scared than you're supposed to be, but it's not bad to be as scared as you should be. You know, there are people around the world now who are starting to frame climate change as exactly the sort of mean villain story that our species is wired to respond to. And the mean villain in that story is the Western world, and particularly America. People all over the world are starting to think, you know, what's happening around the globe is due to human activity, but it's mainly due to the disproportionate activity of those people over there. I think the narrative is going to undergo a change in the next decade, in which we are seen as the perpetrators, the villains in this saga. And, you know, when there's a villain, there are quickly people who rise to confront him.
Well, obviously the climate issue is, that's a subject of many possible multi-hour interviews, and so we won't solve it here and now. But I do think that the psychology of it is incredibly interesting. Part of me thinks that there's a winning combination. It's not just deep fear, but hope as well may turn out to be the winning sort of psychological mix. Because there's, I know Steve Pinker has argued this, that if you go too far down the fear route, that you can engender a kind of fatalism on it that just doesn't work.
There's no doubt about that. You have to be sufficiently afraid to be motivated to take action, but you have to believe that if your action is successful, your fear will be alleviated. So there is a balance between the two. But I don't think too many people have sunk into their chair and decided, the end is coming, why should I bother? I think people are actually on the other side of that equation. They haven't yet gotten very afraid, because they see some things happening that, you know, sound like the little tinkling of a bell that may be tolling for us, but it seems in the far future. It's often in some other place. It's happening to some other people, and they are going about their lives as if none of this is real. So right now, I'm not too worried about erasing hope. Mm-hmm. I think there's plenty of hope, maybe just a little bit too much of it. We can worry about being too afraid a little bit later. Right now, we have to be worried, I think, about not being quite afraid enough.
So interesting. So interesting, Dan Gilbert. If you could inject one single idea, top priority idea for you that you can inject into the minds of people listening here, what do you want us to go away with from your work, from your thinking, Dan?
Oh my gosh. That's a big burden. You should have told me you wanted me to answer that question, and I would have studied and thought deeply about it. What is the big idea? If there's one thing that we have to worry about, It's that our brains are doing something that brains have only been doing for a short amount of time, which is thinking about the long-term future. We're the only animal that can do it, so hurrah, hurrah for us. And it's gotten us pretty far, but we're not good enough at it. Right now, we are on a train that is hurtling towards the edge of a cliff. We can see it. We can calculate it. Scientists can tell us precisely when the train will arrive. And yet, somehow, we're not able to bring ourselves to do anything about it. We will, of course. The moment we're at the edge of the cliff, we will do exactly what animals like us do. We will holler, we will scream, we will fight, we will do everything we can to stay alive. But unfortunately, some problems can't be solved if you wait too long to start solving them. And that's my greatest fear about our species, is that we haven't fully harnessed our powers of foresight, that we haven't realized what's looming ahead of us and are willing to take action in the present to do something about it.
Eloquently said, Dan Gilbert. What a delight it's been to spend this time going over this. Like, I think the magic of the human mind that you've devoted your life to not just uncovering, but explaining to people. I mean, there just isn't a more extraordinary topic out there to be had. And the consequences of what we do with this knowledge honestly couldn't be greater. So thank you for this. Thank you for your work and for spending this time with us now.
My pleasure entirely.
Professor Dan Gilbert teaches psychology at Harvard. He's the author of Stumbling on Happiness. To listen to his TED Talks, visit TED.com. This week's show was produced by Megan Tan. Our production manager is Roxanne Hilash. Our mix engineer, David Herman. Our theme music is by Alison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to my colleague, Michelle Quint. If you like this show, please share it with someone else who is curious. You could also write a brief review of the TED interview on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Chris Anderson. Thanks so much for listening. On the next episode, neuroscientist Anil Seth and I dive into what is perhaps humanity's biggest mystery, consciousness. What is it? How does the brain create it? And why does it even exist? You could argue these are the most important questions there are.
Consciousness is the only thing that matters. You know, for each of us individually, for any system, you know, all our morals, all our ethics, all our joy, all our pain, all our suffering only has the meaning that it has because it impacts and is manifest through conscious experiences that exist for somebody or for something.